gut health for mental health, the bi-directional communication pathway that is the gut-brain axis. And let's also explore the microorganisms that absolutely inhabit our body, the microbiome. Welcome to the Vital Veda Show. I'm your host, Dylan Smith. Thanks so much for joining me. I'm an Ayurvedic practitioner and holistic health educator based in Sydney, Australia, but spreading the love and the knowledge everywhere. Hope you're enjoying the radical transformation that nature is organizing for us right now. I hope you're grateful and enjoying your self-isolation and all the wonderful things that you can be doing. So I know I personally have been loving, I've been getting a lot of reading done, I've been doing a lot of studying, and as speaking to my guru, my teacher, he really emphasized me to do more chanting, inward chanting, which we call japa, specifically because I've been initiated into Dhanvantri, which means the perfect health aspect of consciousness and the health aspect of the consciousness of life, specifically through the Ayurveda. So I have a responsibility and a capability, as I've been initiated in these processes, to promote health in society and in others. And one of the methods I do that is through chanting certain mantras, certain primordial sounds. So that's something he's really emphasizing me to do more. And, you know, although we can gain a cosmic conscious view of this is all nature, it's all happening for a reason, everything is evolutionary, unfortunately it had to be rough, but, you know, it's still for the very good, which it is. But that being said, we should not just be bystanders and pacifists and allow it to just go by. We need to kind of make it as smooth as we can and as harmonious as we can and as pacifists. So, you know, we've got stuff to do, and, you know, maintain our groundedness and maintain our ocean-like status, which is our nature, our true absolute self amongst the absolute turmoil and stress that is going on. So anyway, not going to go much into COVID-19. Me and Cribben recorded this in about the third week of March 2020, so in the midst of the COVID-19, just when it's really starting to pick up and shit's getting more serious. So and we talk about that, and Cribben has an absolutely beautiful view, and not just a view, the science about viruses and microbiome, and he's really an expert. Cribben Govinda, he's a food scientist, a registered nutritionist, and the founder of Nourish Me Organics, a company specializing in gut health and mitochondrial health focused products. And he's got a beautiful podcast called The Gut Health Guru. So he's basically a gut health guru. He's got more than 20 years of experience in the food industry and has a very deep insight into that, which we've talked about. And yeah, he's got an amazing story of rising from depression and suicide and fixing that mainly with gut health, which we talk about. So I'm excited for you guys to meet him and hear what he's got to say. It's really wonderful at this time because he to understand the greater microorganisms that share this earth and really that not only inhabit our body, but we are 90% bugs, basically. We are 90% microbes and 10% humans. So we really got to understand these microorganisms more. And viruses are included in the microbiome, like this COVID-19 that we are being blessed with by the destruction operator of nature. So embrace yourselves, get your pens and papers. One thing that I've really excited to do is I've ordered, still haven't got them yet, kefir grains from Cribben's company to make kefir, which is a fermented beverage, just to really enhance microbiome health. If you guys want to get any kits from Cribben's store, he's got a pretty amazing store of making your own fermented foods and sourdough bread, and he's got a pretty extensive store on microbiome and mitochondrial health. It's Nourish Me Organics. You guys can get a discount code with Vital Veda. If you enjoy the show, enjoy what I do, I'd love your support. You can tag Vital Veda on Instagram, tag Gut Health Gurus if you want to share this with people who can benefit, who need help with their gut, who want to understand more about the microbiome and understand more about this coronavirus and be enlightened. You know, we did a podcast on the microbiome and on viruses with Jimmy Wallenbeam. I believe it's about three episodes ago, and it changed a lot of people. It helped a lot of people living in fear with this coronavirus because they actually understand what this, what viruses actually are and the role they play in life. So that was more depth in this. This is primarily about, you know, microbiome and gut health and mental health, but definitely the views that he has on viruses is pretty profound. So yes, tag us, leave a review on your podcast app. Subscribe, this really helps. If you want to make a donation, you can on the podcast page in the Vital Vader, or just check out the Vital Vader online shop. There's some pretty awesome products, and that would also be supporting. And check out the other episodes of the show. There's so much awesome stuff. And hey guys, I want to know, who should I be interviewing? What topics do you want to hear? Let me know. Mention on the Vital Vader community Facebook group, which you guys can join, which is a, we go a bit more deeper in the sharing of knowledge, and we collaborate with all our members, and people can ask questions, and then you get views from other people. It's a pretty special place. So join that, the Vital Vader community Facebook group. The newsletter is where you'll get the more detailed information and special offers coming from me, coming from the herbs. We've just been absolutely crazy on the herb orders with this virus. Everyone's suddenly taken up to their immunity, and even my friend who runs water filter company, Nick and Pimax, he's also, you know, gone crazy on the water filters. I think people are really starting to, take action on their health. And I think it's really amazing what's happening. And I think a big thing which is changing, just quickly back on the subject, is dharma, which means what is the most evolutionary thing you can be doing right now? A big thing in the collectives are going to change is dharma. People are going to be questioning, should I really be working like this? Is 9 to 5 really what I'm meant to be doing? Anyway, we're going to do a whole episode on this, all this kind of view of work and purpose and what really should we be doing and what is going on. Probably with Gary Gorrow, I intend to. So we'll see in another future episode, but subscribe, stay in the loop with that, and once again, share it and enjoy.
I'm a big fan of your podcast. Congratulations on it. It's pretty amazing.
Thanks, man.
Ruben, I listened to your video that you did on COVID. It was really great how you were vulnerable and expressed how you're feeling anxiety, thus gut issues, in the first time in a while. So I'm just checking how you're going now with it all.
Yeah, pretty good. I mean, I have to kind of work extra hard to address those anxiety and mental health challenges. So it's just having that self-awareness to feel it in my body and know that it's not quite right. And I'm experiencing these digestive discomforts because I'm doing everything right in terms of all the different gut health strategies, but now it just reminds me that I've got to be cognizant of also the mental health strategies, because the gut and the brain is very intimately connected, and things that affect your mental health affect your gut health and vice versa. So it just reminds me, you know, to take time off, to relax, to meditate, to do my Alexander practices and all these different mental health strategies that I have, expressing gratitude, spending time in nature. So it's just a good reminder for me.
Yeah, beautiful. And hopefully you are getting that time off right now with
Oh, look, it's hard, Dylan. I mean, now we're all in kind of lockdown. The kids, because I'm an extremely introverted character, so I need to have lots of time alone, and that's my struggle at the moment, because being locked down with a wife and 3 kids is not easy to get the me time, but you know, we do the best we can.
I'd suggest go to some nature.
Yeah,
like isolated nature for half a day or a day.
Totally. Just going to the park or going for a walk around the block, or even just sitting in the backyard by myself and meditating.
Yeah, that's it. I just hope, you know, people with all the isolation happening, that they're not isolating from nature and that they're getting out in the sun and in the nature and, yeah, not scared to leave their home for that. As long as you're responsible and don't go near people, that's fine.
Totally.
Let's go back up a bit into what you're currently experiencing, and will you tell us about your story and how you, and then essentially how you got into health? I'm not fully aware of your full story.
Yeah, sure. I've told the story many times over the last 8 or 9 years, but about 9 years ago, I was in a pretty successful career. I mean, I've been a food scientist for a long time, so I've been in the food industry for about 20 years in total. But at the time, I was kind of progressing in my career And as you progress in your career, I mean, the level of stress goes down as you move up the chain of command in any company. The level of stress exponentially rises. And at that time, I'd moved into a more commercial type role. So I was in procurement, and literally the sheer level of stress that I was under, my life just imploded. And having struggled with anxiety and depression for most of my life, it just amplified the whole situation. And when I think back on when my struggle with anxiety and depression first started, it was literally, when I think back retrospectively, it was in my kind of mid-teens, because I'd gone on this family vacation overseas and got extremely sick. I picked up a nasty, nasty bug. It's called Shigella dysentery. So it's a very nasty, common kind of food poisoning bug, and literally lost 10 kilos because I was sitting in the toilet like seven times a day. So just losing all fluids, all sorts of electrolytes, and I was just couldn't eat. I was just losing weight. I was already skinny, and on top of that, I was losing 10 kilos. So I was like a skeleton. And when I came back from the trip, went to the doctors, and the doctors put me on a very, very harsh regime of antibiotics and literally nuked the hell out of this bug, but I think also nuked the hell out of my microbiome. And so I went from being a really popular, happy-go-lucky kid to overnight becoming extremely angsty, depressed, kind of angry, and very recluse. And I kind of held that for pretty much for most of my life after that. It was only till I discovered all the importance of gut brain and gut health that I managed to overturn a lot of those struggles. So going back to the career, so you kind of build these strategies to deal with the anxiety and depression. You put on all sorts of protectors and masks and to carry you through life. But then all those protectors and guards that I put on to function in society and function in life just collapsed. So I had a breakdown, had a marriage collapse, found myself in the city by myself. I was literally living in an apartment in the city and got bullied out of the workplace, actually, because I wasn't functioning in the workplace. And it was, you know, a tough economic time, just like it is now back then. And literally, I went from being a really high performing employee to someone that was struggling. And then, you know, it was difficult, but extremely difficult for me. But my boss was just bullying me. And literally, the strategy that the company took was they were giving all sorts of redundancy packages to everyone. But for some reason, maybe certain people, they just tried to bully out. And that's what they did to me. So they bullied me out of the workplace, and I found myself in the city ready to end my life. So I was sitting in my apartment ready to end it all. The only thing that really saved me was anchoring onto my three beautiful children and not wanting to leave a legacy of a father that quit and gave up. So I kept fighting, put my science cap on, went back into the research and the literature, and just by fluke stumbled on the work of Dr. Natasha Campbell McBride, who has an autistic child. And she was the first scientist that very clearly articulated from what I'd seen in the literature, the connection between the gut and the brain. So I deep dived into her work. It was very early days in terms of the microbiome research as well. So it was all coming together, and I pretty much discovered that it's very, very important to deal with digestive issues when it comes to dealing with things like anxiety and depression. So that's the short version of the story. Mm. But you know, there's all sorts of strategies that I use. So making massive changes in my diet, being in the food industry for so long, I intimately understand what goes in the food. I've been to more than 100 food manufacturing sites across the world, so I intimately understand the food system, what goes in the food, And so it was very easy for me to say, oh God, you know, I've got to cut out all the processed foods because I know half the stuff that goes in the food is not even on the label. So it's such a slippery slope when you think about what's happening in the food industry. So stripped back that, started going to the market and buying fresh fruits and vegetables, started to implement fermented foods. I went to a psychologist at the time as well, and they got me started onto a meditation practice. Then I went on to do also transcendental meditation, yoga, regular yoga practice. What else was I doing? I also took up acting. It's so counterintuitive, but I literally just saw this advertisement for a free acting class, and I thought, well, let's give this a go. And so I walked into this acting class, and it was the most authentic group of people that I've ever seen in my life, and there were actors. So you kind of think that actors are pretending, but the essential art of especially the Meisner technique is to learn how to be yourself and not put on all these masks and protectors. And it's how to literally unmask yourself. It's like an onion. It's taking off all the layers and getting to the very core of your authentic being. And acting was one of the lifesavers for me as well.
Yeah, wonderful. And I'm very glad you persisted because you're doing wonderful things for the world and developed a really great community, which is really being emphasized here with nature's divine plan of what's going on right now.
Mm-hmm.
And nature's intelligence of so many wonderful things coming out from this. I've seen, of course, there's also a lot of serious health implications happening, but we need to remember that absolutely everything in nature and every event is evolutionary, as rough as it may seem. And unfortunately, it has to be rough and destructive at times in order to, if the humans aren't, you know, or if we're not, you know, kind of listening to the laws of nature or not going with it, then it's going to get rough. But everything still is evolutionary. And although, yes, there's many things, one of the beautiful things out of the quite a few things that have come out of this is the importance of community and the we in wellness. And not just at a, not just at a human level and society level, but getting familiar with not just the humans, but other microorganisms such as bacteria and viruses.
Mm.
Getting a bigger picture of what actually are these things and losing this terrorist mentality, I think. And this we haven't got because we are right now, and these viruses are terrorists that we have to. But we'll talk about microbiome and viruses in a bit. But before we do, let's stay on the topic of gut-brain axis. And can you, I guess, yeah, highlight some of the key connections? And many people have heard, because it's pretty hot science, and as you that this gut-brain axis is a, you know, bidirectional communication pathway, which is highly influential on each other. So will you, yeah, give some of the main correlations, I guess?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's still very early days, so it's hard to jump to causation when it comes to the connection between the gut and the brain. But what we do know is that there's a connection via the enteric nervous system. So there's a nerve called the vagus nerve, which connects the gut and the brain together. And you know, there's studies suggesting that. And firstly, to explain what the microbiome is. So the microbiome is like an organ. So it weighs around 2 kilos. So it's the combination of the bacteria, the yeast, the viruses, the parasites, all these different microorganisms plus their genes. So that collective is known as the microbiome. The microbiota is just the individual organism. So microbiome just encompasses all the genetic material and all these different genes that are floating around in the gut. And so what scientists are establishing is that when you have, for instance, stress or you're stressed out, it causes changes in the microbiome composition. So it can alter the different types of bacteria and yeast and all these different microorganisms in the gut. But conversely, what's happening in the gut, you know, the production of metabolites, so metabolites being things that these microbes actually produce, can also influence how you feel. So a classic one is GABA. So GABA is a compound that's produced in the gut by your gut bacteria, and also the other ones that are produced in very high quantities is serotonin, about 80%, actually it's more, it's about 90 plus percent produced in the gut, and dopamine around 50% produced in the gut. So we know these are hormones that influence mood, but scientists haven't clearly established how it actually impacts the brain, whether it can cross the blood-brain barrier and whatnot. But they're still working that out. But what we know is that these hormones could potentially impact how you feel. So that's basically how the brain impacts the gut and how the gut impacts the brain. But most of the communication is actually going from gut to brain. So it's very interesting that there's just through evolution or through nature that this system has been developed. And the microbes in the gut, you know, we can hypothesize that these microbes are influencing their own ability to survive by communicating directly to us through the vagus nerve and into the brain. So a classic example is Candida. You know, Candida loves sugar. So this could potentially lead to how we have cravings for things like sugar. So the food that we eat is actually also food for the microbes that live in the gut.
I'd like to, just on Candida, and my understanding is that it's a yeast that is basically stealing nutrients, so that's why your body is craving these sugars and simple carbohydrates, because it's stealing it. And then, is that, would you say that's right?
Yeah, that's correct. And I mean, there's no such, to just very clearly set the frame from the start, there's no such thing as a good and bad microorganism or bacteria or yeast. Yeah. It's just an ecosystem. So it's a 2-kilo organ. It's the only, this is the microbiome. So the microbiome is the only organ in the body that can dramatically change to environmental stimuli. It's just an evolutionary trait that we've developed. So we can go into any ecosystem, and then the microbiome, based on what food we're putting in our mouths and other environmental stimuli, can very quickly shift within a matter of hours or days. You know, it's really quick in its shifting, because it has to, because most of the genes in our body are not actually in our cells. Most of them are in the microbiome. There's 100 times more genes in the microbiome than there are in the cells in our body. So it's a very, very quick shifting organ that can adapt to the environment. And this is a huge advantage for the human species because, for instance, if we run out of food and then we have to shift to other ways of, you know, other types of food that we're not used to, the microbiome can very quickly shift and fill in a lot of gaps for us by the genes that they're expressing. But then there's also direct communication between the microbiome and also the genes in our body as well. So the cells in our body via genetic expression. So it's a very, very powerful, important organ. And my point is with Candida, it's not necessarily that Candida is a bad thing. It's just when it gets out of balance. When the microbiome is out of balance is when we can potentially see the expression of disease. So Candida albicans is a very classic pathogenic microbe, meaning pathogen, meaning disease causing. But Candida also has biological significance to help us break down heavy metals. So, and we see this across the board with things that we think that are pathogenic. For instance, parasites, we think that are like they're bad, but they're not necessarily bad, because parasites are like the like the top of the food chain in the gut. They're like the apex predator. So they help keep balance in that ecosystem. It's only when they get out of balance is when disease manifests. So it's always important to keep that in mind, that there's no such thing as good and bad. It's just balance.
So important. And that's why we have to really change this mentality against, essentially this war mentality against microbiome.
And
healing you with things like probiotics and, sorry, antibiotics. Probiotics is another story, but antibiotics, like, I have to kill this. It's not about, exactly as you said, well, it's not good or bad. It's about creating a harmonious environment so that the candida can be there and not become pathogenic and do its job, and the parasites can do the wonderful job
that they do.
And then to give this approach to viruses is an interesting and perhaps much harder for people to fathom. But I guess, and especially with something like this, but I guess it's the same. It would be the same concept, right? Like,
it's the same. It's exactly the same. I mean, most of the microorganisms in our body, the vast majority, are either they're just there and they're just doing their jobs. Some, when they're out of balance, can create disease. You know, for instance, viruses, I think, have a very important purpose in nature. I mean, they're the only ones that can very quickly change your genome. I mean, that this is the research that people, the coronavirus, for instance, the coronavirus is just a type of virus. The one that we're seeing now, COVID-19, is creating some problems because it's novel. So the immune systems around the world haven't experienced this. So there's a concept in science called, or immunology, is called herd immunity. So it just means that we don't have herd immunity to keep the virus at bay because it's novel, it's new. The body has no defense mechanism against it. So we need to develop, that's why they're working on treatments and vaccines and to develop herd immunity. But because it doesn't exist yet, that's why it's a problem. But the vast majority of viruses, this is my hypothesis, is that the function of viruses in nature is to, again, it's to change your genome. It's nature's innate way to actually change genes, because they're one of the only things in nature that can actually get into your cell, hijack the cell, and change the genes in it. You can actually insert genes into cells. So with all the gene modification technologies that are being developed, they are actually using coronaviruses to actually implement these gene therapy protocols. So this is what scientists have been doing for many years. Now with this coronavirus, it's COVID-19, it's novel, and hence it's a problem, because it doesn't kill us per se through, you know, sort of overwhelming the immune system. It's the immune system's reaction to it that kills people. It's this concept called a cytokine storm. So it's just when the immune system is just out of control, it's trying to knock out this virus, and then the immune system starts attacking you, and that's what kills people. And that's what we're seeing, you know, hemolysis of blood cells, and blood cells explode, or, you know, attacking lungs, you know, parts of the lungs. It's the body attacking itself, and that's what kills us.
That's an absolutely beautiful hypothesis that you mentioned, that the virus is coming to change our genes for whatever reason. So, and do you have any opinions on what could be that reason in the future or near future? Why are our genes being changed by nature?
I think it's just, again, it's just my thinking. I just think it's nature's way of allowing us to adapt and change, because, you know, nature has its own rhythms and shifts, and somehow this has been built into our environment. I mean, we're not disconnected from nature. We're part of nature. We view ourselves as being individual from nature, but we're all part of this ecosystem. So nature has built this beautiful tool, and viruses are just packets of information. They're packets of RNA and DNA. So they're just information. And this is nature's way of getting information into our bodies. It's just a mechanism, you know. So these viruses are just packets of information floating around, and the way they propagate themselves is they get into a cell, they inject their information into the cell, they force the cell to produce more copies of itself, the cell explodes and the virus propagates and then spreads onto other cells. But most of the time, these things are happening, you know, in a safe, without impacting us, not causing disease. You know, you might get a cold, you might get a flu, but then the immune system deals with it. But then it's still impacting its change, so that code is still inside of us now. So it's implemented its actual change. But the problem is when you've got a novel virus and no one knows where this virus came from, there's all sorts of theories. We don't actually know. We won't know probably for many years. But for some reason, the body, it's novel. It's new. So the body just doesn't know how to deal with it, and that's the issue.
Yeah, that's interesting, because my next question was how did we deal with the novel viruses in the past, anthropologically speaking, when we didn't have, you know, these modern scientific, I guess, laboratory productions to make us cope with it? But then you look at the theories of where it came from, whether it was from an animal or whether it was from this high biosecurity lab, then I guess that's kind of more of a human caused in the world rather than in the past, anthropologically speaking, it would have come from nature. But what would you think about that, about introducing novel viruses in the past?
I think firstly, I mean, our ancestors were like the big one I can think about is the Spanish flu. Again,
that was the early 1900s, was it?
1917, 1918. It's around World War One time. But yeah, that was the big one. So what happened was millions and millions of people died. But then again, we would have developed we developed herd immunity. So people died. A lot of people died. But then certain people developed immunity. And then we developed herd immunity, and then the virus can't spread. As soon as you develop herd immunity, then, you know, it's not going to jump from people, because the immune systems of those that are resilient to combat it take care of it, and then the spread stops. So it's a very different world now. We're so connected, you know. It's easy and cheap to just jump on a plane anywhere in the world. So it's unprecedented. So we're seeing a level of connectivity that we've never seen before as well. So it's also the advent of human advancement that adds another layer of complexity. Whereas in the past, we're all separated by oceans or mountains or rivers, and we're all separated into small little tribes and villages where these things could be contained. Whereas now, because of globalization, you know, it's unprecedented. So in 1917, 1918, you know, people could still jump on ships and stuff. So hence that flu spread throughout the whole world and created a massive issue. So that's my thinking on it anyway.
No, that's beautiful. And okay. And yeah, it just seems like it's, you know, occasionally every few decades or more, and we got to get our hit of a virus, right? And whether it's novel and change our genes. This is evolution. Things change, and it can be rough when millions of people die. That's how it is.
That's nature, right? Nature can be quite cruel sometimes. And the other factor to consider is that our immune systems, this is my thinking as well, our immune systems are compromised as well. I think certainly being compromised by, you know, things like antibiotics and anything that's damaging mitochondria. So this is another whole rabbit hole to fall into. But from the research that I've looked at, mitochondria are like the very early warning systems in the body. So mitochondria themselves are also ancient bacteria that through evolution of being embedded inside a cell. So they're endosymbiotic bacteria that many, potentially millions, billions, who knows, years ago, embedded inside the cell. But being archaea, so very ancient types of bacteria, like archaea, like not even classified as bacteria, they're like a separate group of microbe. So this is the ancestry of your mitochondria inside the cells. But these mitochondria are like your very early warning systems in the body, which then signal to the genome. So they're like the link between the microbiome and the cell genome. So it's like the conduit between. But it turns out that science is suggesting that these are very early warning systems. And a lot of the modern insults are things like, you know, potentially electromagnetic radiation, artificial lighting, all the chemicals coming through our food, air pollution, also, you know, certain things in our water. So all these things are creating insults to your mitochondria, because you have to think these things are very ancient types of microbes. So anything that could potentially be damaging microbes could also be potentially damaging the mitochondria. So it's a very complex issue, but I certainly think a lot of the modern things that we take for granted, like simply lighting or electromagnetic fields, your Wi-Fi, your Bluetooth, all these things could be potentially damaging your mitochondria, which is then impacting the immune system. And then simple things like just overconsumption of sugar. So sugar is also one of these very damaging things in the body.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say potentially damaging. It's pretty evident. There's good science on that they are damaging to the mitochondria. And yeah, that's what I was thinking when, you know, in terms of our ancestors in the past introducing a novel virus, is that they would have stronger immune systems and they didn't have all these mitochondrial insults, as you put it. So yeah,
absolutely.
Okay. And so let's go back to the gut-brain axis. And can we go a bit more into this? You mentioned a couple of hormones, serotonin, dopamine, and the amino acid GABA. But you're saying it's produced in the gut only, so it's not even, we're not sure if it's entering the brain itself. Is that right?
So, but 90%+ is produced in the gut, but the brain also does produce it. But we don't know whether the serotonin that's produced in the gut actually crosses the blood-brain barrier and impacts the brain. Mm-hmm. We can hypothesize it does, but we just don't have the evidence yet. But I mean, anecdotally, I feel that maintaining a healthier gut has certainly improved my mood. So that's just anecdotal, but I haven't seen any studies to support serotonin produced in the gut having impact in the brain. What we do know from preclinical studies is that you can take the microbiome of a depressed person and put it in a mouse and then create these depressive anxiety symptoms in a mouse. So we've got that type of science to fall on, but we haven't reached that sort of human level data yet, but it will come.
But also people were taking probiotics and that was improving their mental health.
Yeah. Things like you can see studies around kefir, you know, around, this is a beautiful fermented food that you can make at home. So kefir definitely improved. I saw a study coming out of Turkey where they had a cohort of people with inflammatory bowel disease, I think it was, and they certainly showed in this study that it improved their quality of life. So that's how they measured it. So there is some evidence, but I think we need more. We need more to definitively say. So, and you can also take a microbiome from someone with autism and put it in a mouse and trigger those type of symptoms in a mouse as well. So you're seeing those type of studies. There's also studies on obesity. So you can take the microbiome from an obese person, put it in a mouse and trigger obesity in the mouse. So these are all the preclinical studies that we're seeing.
I would definitely think that even if the, you know, these hormones like serotonin, dopamine, GABA are not going into the brain, just being in the gut will definitely have some effect. I mean, GABA is very, is responsible for, it balances mood and reduces stress and helps with sleep. And that definitely would still have an effect, even if it's secreting in the gut.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's also important to note that the gut is like a, it's called the second brain. So it has its own innate intelligence. Like we know that if you're feeling a bit anxious or you're feeling nervous, you typically feel it in the gut because there's a whole enteric nervous system as much as a small cat in terms of the number of nerves. So it's a separate, it's almost like a separate brain that sits in your gut.
Yeah.
And so it's modulating, all your peristalsis and, going to the toilet and all that kind of stuff. And it's a little bit crude, but if you're scared or if you're anxious, it's very hard to go to the toilet, So it's like this inbuilt mechanism in there that when you have your toilet habits, you want to kind of be comfortable in that environment. If you're kind of jolted or scared, it's very hard to go poo.
Yeah, totally. And as you said, the second brain, and in Ayurveda, we see this gut brain connection, and it's on the axes of the vata, we call it. And the top vata is the pranavata, which is the brain, and then the apanavata is the lower stomach. And yeah, Chinese medicine calls it the dantian, second brain. And definitely, especially that's why a lot of people in the morning when they meditate, either during the meditation or after the meditation, then they get their morning bowel motion, which of course should be happening every day, first thing before you eat anything or before any coffee. You should have a good complete bowel motion. This is, proper elimination according to Ayurveda, unfortunately not according to modern science, who says even four times a week is classified normal. So they meditate, and I guess what we call the vata, or the nervous energy or the movements, goes downward, and that's the way vata is meant to go down, this air and space element, everything moving, whether it's neurotransmitters, blood circulation. And then another one, butyric acid, that's also produced in the gut and is related with the mental health, right?
Yeah, so butyrate is a very important short chain fatty acid that's produced from a couple of different sources. The main one is just breaking down plant material that creates these short chain fatty acids. So, fiber, prebiotics, things like that can be broken down into butyrate. And you can also get butyrate from things like butter. Some dairy products also have butyrate. Ghee is another good one that has butyrate in there. But butyrate is the energy or the fuel source for the colonic cells in the gut. So they're responsible for actually fueling these gut cells. So extremely important for proper gut barrier function, to make sure you're not getting things like leaky gut, just to make sure that these cells are actually working properly and also secreting enough mucus. So you've got a couple of different layers of protection in the gut lining. Firstly, you've got your tight junctions, which is a very thin layer. You take a hair and you cut it cross-sectionally in half. It's literally one cell deep, very thin lining in the gut. And then the gut cells actually secrete mucin, and it secretes two layers. And so mucin is like, you think about saliva, like this mucus layer that's actually secreted by the gut cells to offer a second layer of protection. And then within the actual lumen of the gut is where, all the bacteria essentially live. Some of them also live within the mucosal layers as well. So butyrate is extremely important, most importantly to have enough fiber, making sure you're having enough plant-based fibers to make sure that the gut cells are getting enough butyrate to function properly, and especially to produce mucin. But all these, they all help, like when you're having issues with having enough fiber, then it lends itself to creating something called leaky gut. And leaky gut is when those colonic cells that are lined up, the junctions are not tight enough, and then you've got an imbalance of gut bacteria, certain types of gut bacteria produce a compound called lipopolysaccharides, so LPS. But LPS has also been shown to create systemic inflammation and also create issues with mental health as well. But primarily, they just, it's like the body is being invaded by foreign bacteria. It's like literally like sepsis. It's like bacteria leaking from the lumen inside the gut to the space inside the gut, crossing through that junction into the bloodstream. And when you have high levels of LPS, it triggers all sorts of health issues, diabetes, also can pass through the blood-brain barrier and create inflammation in the brain, which lends itself to mental health issues as well. Alzheimer's, you know, or Parkinson's, things like that. There's links between LPS and these brain or neurodegenerative dysfunctions. So it's very important to maintain, firstly, tight junctions in the gut, and secondly, to ensure that the gut is producing adequate amounts of mucin just to protect against this LPS. And then lastly, to make sure the balance of the bacteria don't include too much of these LPS-producing bacteria, which tend to be a group of bacteria called proteobacteria. And proteobacteria, they typically like huge, like they like high amounts of, like, especially red meat or too much saturated fats, and then not balancing enough with fiber, because fiber is the one that creates short chain fatty acids, but then short chain fatty acids also slightly acidify the colon to prevent an overbloom of these proteobacteria. So that's why it's very important to get enough fiber. Like in Australia, we have a huge problem with not having enough fiber because, you know, and just not eating enough diversity of plant foods. That's one of our biggest problems. And we're not creating enough of this butyrate in the gut. And that's why one of the reasons why we have such a high rate of colon cancer. So hopefully that explains why such an important issue to have enough fiber. But then there's other issues as well. It's such a complex issue. I mean, diet is only one part of the story, but then you also have to consider things like emerging research. There's a concept called rhythmicity, or you'll see advents of the science called chronobiology or circadian rhythms. So again, it's all going back to nature. The way the body works and also the bacteria, they all work based on a circadian rhythm. So even the bacteria in the gut shifts through the day. So there's different levels of certain types of bacteria as you progress through the day. This is how nature's designed us. And it's all on light signaling. So it seems so counterintuitive, but one of the most important things you can actually do for your gut health and to make sure that these colon cells are actually functioning properly is to actually entrain the body to the sun. So, you know, I know in certainly in ancient Indian culture and many cultures in the world, they worship the sun because the sun is one of the most important elements for humanity because everything is based on the light and dark cycle. So it's so important to actually wake up in the morning and get sunlight, actual sunlight outside. And even if it's 5 or 10 minutes, you know, going for a walk for 5 or 10 minutes, because this programs circadian rhythm, which then alters the actual immune system in a way that modulates the type of bacteria in the gut. This is like really cutting edge science. The study only came out a couple of months ago to suggest this, that essentially what the body is trying to do is the body is almost like think about a farmer, like it's actually modulating the composition of the gut microbiome to create homeostasis. But a lot of the signaling is all to do with circadian rhythm, the sun hitting your eyes in the morning and then informing, there's a small little part of your brain called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. So that is the master clock in the body. So this is what sets the timing in the body, and then the suprachiasmatic nucleus then signals to all the other cells in the body exactly what time of day it is. And all of that is based on light signaling. So if you're a night shift worker, straight away you have higher risks of most diseases because the circadian rhythm is all out of whack. So, you know, getting bright light in your eyes at night then again confuses the clock. It doesn't know whether it's day or night. So it's super simple. Get sunlight in your eyes in the morning. Get a dose of sun on your skin and eyes in the midday, and then eliminate as much as you can all artificial light at night, especially really bright, we call blue light. So it's a wavelength of about 400 to about 490 nanometers, but that's that really white fluorescent or LED type lighting that's literally signaling to your body that it's in the middle of the day. And it also signals for the body to produce cortisol. So this, again, is creating a level of stress, underlying stress, because the body is creating too much cortisol. Because cortisol is supposed to be produced, and this is stress hormone, this is supposed to be produced in the morning when the sunlight hits your eyes to get you going for the day. But in the nighttime, you want the body to actually produce melatonin. And so cortisol and melatonin cancel each other out almost, so they interfere with each other. So you've got to get this dark cycle at night for melatonin to then be produced at substantial levels to actually create a nice, deep, restful sleep. But the signaling is all driven by light, so it's so important.
Yeah, beautiful. And I can't wait to keep going with this with you, Crippen, because most people listening here are pretty good with the diet. You know, they're not eating crap, basically, and they're eating whole foods. And I see a lot of people, and I'm sure you do as well, and everyone's saying it in this industry of, I guess, the health industry, and people who are more conscious of their health, they're not considering circadian medicine, and they're just thinking all about diet, and they need to refine more. So hopefully today you can learn these things. And also, I would like to refine, since you're an expert with the gut, like refine the gut as well. And see, like, for example, what, and just before we go into the gut, just on the circadian rhythms. So after sunset, for you listening, you should use blue light blocking glasses. Like, you can check out Raw Optics, RA Optics. Yeah. Really an absolutely essential tool in today's society. I mean, it's going to reduce the light temperature, so your brain doesn't think it's midday at nighttime. It's going to reduce that a bit. And similarly with the computer, you can download a fantastic software called Iris Tech. And it's absolutely essential. And I love how it's become really popular to use these softwares. All the big companies and corporate companies with offices, they're all using them, and people are valuing it because it definitely helps a lot. You can see the light temperature, which is measured in Kelvin. You can have a 6,500 Kelvin, which is the midday sun. And you don't want to be looking at that at nighttime, because then the cortisol increases, melatonin goes down, as Crippen said. So you can manually do it to what you want. For a candle, for example, that's what I usually have my screen on, 1900 Kelvin rather than 6500. Mm-hmm. So, and just to emphasize that, of course, Ayurveda and all that, so many traditional cultures worships the sun. And just a key, simple, foundational recommendation for health is eat with the sun. You have this thing in your digestion called Agni, which means digestive fire, and it's regulated by the sun. So when the sun's the strongest, your digestion is the strongest. So lunch should be the biggest meal of them all. And at nighttime, the sun's down, you have weak digestion. So don't eat. If you're about to go to sleep, you want to regulate, you know, you want to secrete melatonin and detox the liver and all the wonderful repair and rejuvenative mechanisms that occur. You do not want to digest in food.
Yeah, exactly. And I'll add to that, there's also studies suggesting that the light that you're eating under also impacts the blood glucose levels as well. So you think about someone trying to lose weight or someone trying to maintain a healthy body weight, you need proper blood glucose modulation, because blood glucose is what signals production of insulin, and insulin is what shuttles this excess blood glucose into adipose tissue or fat tissue, creating weight gain or more fat gain in the body. So a very simple tool, without getting into the deep science, is to actually just be very cognizant of the light you're eating under. And as much as I can, I actually eat under the sun. So I have my breakfast in the sunlight. I only have two meals a day. So I have my dinner around two to three. Sometimes I might push it to 4 to 5, but latest would be 5, would be my last meal of the day. And all of my meals are under sunlight, because the light hitting your sun very drastically impacts how the body treats that food and metabolizes that food. And again, if you're sitting under very high intensity blue light and eating, the shining of the light on your skin alone is enough to spike your blood glucose.
Wow.
So, and then you add on top of that your meal, and then you've got just too much blood glucose and way too much insulin. And this is how you could potentially develop insulin sensitivity and also diabetes. So be very cognizant of the light you're eating under, because again, diet alone is not the answer. I mean, there have been diets, people going on diets for as long as I can remember. I mean, diets alone don't work. It's literally all these other lifestyle things that you can do, cold therapy, red light therapy, just being really mindful of the light you're eating under, you know, intermittent fasting, all these things are far more effective than just thinking about your macronutrient levels, how much fat, how much carbs, am I on a keto diet, am I on a paleo diet, am I vegan, you know, whatever diet you're using. It's much more complicated than that. The bodies are much more complicated biochemical machine. And the way the science is going is it's going into quantum biology, chronobiology, you know, these sciences that are going to really bring a lot more answers to why diet alone is not enough.
Beautiful. And as Ruben said, we are so, it's so complex, all the biomechanisms, but the beautiful thing about that is nature is also, and that's nature, of course, nature is complex, so we can be simple. So yeah. Rather than trying to figure it all out and I mean, it's interesting to study it, but for those who don't want to and, you know, no need to figure it all out and try to create a diet, or that's why all these diet and fads, they don't last long, like 10, 20 yeah. years. That's not long. People have been eating the same diet for generations, hundreds of years. So the simple thing is eat with nature. Eat according to the season, eat with fresh, whole foods, transcend all the food fads and diets, and eat with nature.
Totally, and local. I'll add to that, local, yeah. Because the food that you eat actually has almost like a GPS signal inside of it. So you think about vegetables. Vegetables are growing with light. So that light energy is still stored within the food. So when we eat local and everything's in alignment, then that circadian match is maintained. So it's so important. Again, we don't need to understand the science. It's just literally eat local and eat with the sun. And I think you know, you're 80% there and implementing some sort of intermittent fasting and not eating too frequently, you know, two, three meals a day, no snacking. And I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised. And then you stack with that some form of you know, cold therapy or something like that, you'll be quite amazed on how easy it is to actually maintain a healthy body weight.
Yeah, Tony, with you on the 2 to 3 meals a day, no snacks, because as a culture, we're eating too much and we need to learn to tap into our own fuel rather than relying on these foods as quick injections of stimulants.
Exactly.
And what were you mentioning? I'm just curious on that. Like the study with eating under light, is that got to do with like cortisol? Like, because I would think eating under blue light, you're activating the sympathetic nervous system response, the flight or fight, and that can perhaps not be the parasympathetic rest and digest.
It could well be, because if the body is under some sort of stressor, it needs more glucose to get you ready to take action. So it could be a stress response, because obviously if you're going to run away from a saber-toothed tiger, you need a burst of energy. So again, it could be related to that mechanism for sure.
And I just want to add, Ayurveda says not to eat in the sun, or at least the hot sun, because you know, we this agni or this digestive fire, when we're in the sun, it kind of goes to the skin. You know, all our blood, all the red blood cells and porphyrins go to the skin to absorb the UV light, and it's not in our stomach. So it's even more important after you eat. We recommend not to be in the sun because you want, again, the blood to be in the digestive fire, the digestive system to be there rather than it going to the skin. So I would personally recommend to not be in intense sun. I personally do eat. It's definitely my lunch in the sun sometimes, especially when I have a long day of work and that's like my only break or one of my only breaks. I'll get every break I can to get out of the sun and to kind of kill two birds. Yeah. You know, you do two things at once with the weather. When I meditate, I'll probably go out in the sun and meditate just so I can use that time to get sun exposure as well.
Yeah, and then, I mean, my meal timings, so my breakfast is going to be about 9 o'clock. Again, the sun is not particularly strong at that time of day. And then my dinner is going to be around 3. So, again, not particularly very strong UV light at that point of day. I think UV would pretty much stop after 3. So again, you're not going to get huge doses of UV. UV is typically going to be happening around the midday, probably around 1:30 at this time in Melbourne would be the highest. So it's not in high UV light. I hear your point. It's definitely going to, if you're sitting under UV, I mean, it's going to be pulling more blood to the skin for sure.
Mm. Yeah. And you can tell as well, like depending on the weather, the strength of the sun, you will feel it. So with the, and just back to the gut lining, ways to optimize our gut lining and our tight junctions so that these, I guess, toxins and unwanted bacteria is not interfering and going in the wrong places. And I'll just share one thing that I like. It's pretty simple. It's more to increase digestive acids, but it's just drinking a large cup of water about 20 minutes or 20 to 30 minutes before a meal, and that kind of pre-hydrates the stomach lining and that water-rich bicarbonate buffer layer, which is there.
Mm.
And that allows acids to reduce, but it kind of, yeah, I love it. Like just before, you know, we know we shouldn't drink so much water during meal because it will dilute the hydrochloric acid and digestive enzymes. Mm-hmm. But drink like a large cup about 30 minutes before, it's a really beautiful pre-hydration effect.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of the leaky gut and gut lining impacts, I can give you a couple of triggers, and then I can give you a couple of things that all these are all based on studies that I've looked at. So I'll give you the actual triggers and things that can actually tighten the gut function. So the triggers are things like gluten, especially if it's coming from a source where it doesn't go through some form of fermentation. So typically, you know, a proper sourdough bread through that fermentation process will lessen the impact of gluten. So if you're going to choose bread, choose something that's fermented, preferably a sourdough. Alcohol is a trigger. Specifically, hops in beer has been shown to be a trigger to make those junctions loose. Capsaicin in chilies. So if you have too much chilies. And then finally, just having elevated blood sugar alone is enough to trigger leaky gut because there's a compound in the blood that's called glycated hemoglobin that actually causes dysfunction in those tight junctions. So definitely eliminate as much sugar as possible, especially from processed foods, because a lot of sugar is hidden in processed foods. So if you're eating fresh produce, then you're going to mitigate a lot of those risks. And things to actually tighten the actual gut junction, you've got flavonoids in berries, citrus fruit, things like that. So fresh fruits, very important. Omega-3 fatty acids, and you can get that from seafood. Fucodan, I can never say that word properly. That's another compound, and that's found in seaweed. So you'll see a lot of the Asian soups, especially from Japan, that incorporate things like kombu or wakame. It's a nice way to get this compound in there. Glutamine is another good one. You can get glutamine from your fermented vegetables like sauerkraut, broccoli, bone broth, collagen peptides. Another one called sulforaphane, which is typically found in broccoli. The highest concentration is found in broccoli sprouts. So if you can, if you've got the time, you can make your own broccoli sprouts. This will be the highest source of sulforaphane. Vitamin A is very important. You can get that from, or vitamin A and vitamin D, these are kind of linked. They're both hormones actually. So vitamin A and vitamin D clearly from the sun, but from food sources for vitamin A and D, the best sources are things like cod liver oil, sardines, offal, like beef livers. Then the next one is zinc. You can get that from oysters. Butyrate, we already talked about, very important fuel for the colonic cells. And then there's a couple of strains of probiotics that you could potentially use to tighten your junctions as well. Lactobacillus GG, you can get that in a supplement, or even some of the yogurts have them. And Lactobacillus reuteri FN041, you can find that in some supplements. And the one I love, my favorite, is actually Megaspore Biotic. So there's, and then obviously a lot of your fermented foods will have some beneficial strains that can help with the tight junctions. The one I love the most in the world is milk kefir. That's my number one go-to in terms of fermented foods. And then an emerging one that people can look at in future, it's still going through a lot of regulatory complexities, but that's CBD oil. And that's having some emerging science to talk about its effect on the actual junctions in the gut as well.
Interesting. Okay. And I'll just add, like, what about, I guess, the function of these tight junctions as well as just, and we've mentioned it, but things like electromagnetic fields, like that will kind of disrupt the ability for them to hold that barrier tight, right?
Yep. So all the ones that I've given you have all got literature behind it, but potentially EMF fields could be an issue. Definitely could be an issue. We definitely need to see some more science behind that, but it doesn't harm at all just to keep the, you know, the 3G off, the 4G off, definitely away from the body, not in your pocket with the phone, you know, on Bluetooth mode or emitting these signals. Definitely it's not going to harm. You know, like, so I don't use Bluetooth at all. I don't use Wi-Fi at all. Everything in my house is hardwired just to mitigate any of those risks, because we know the mitochondria are very sensitive organelles. So we definitely want them to be producing or functioning at their optimal. And definitely there could be some issues with EMF fields and mitochondrial function.
Okay, and let's go into milk kefir, because I know it's very important to you and you advocate a lot. And unfortunately, I'm not familiar with it. Actually, in the past few days before this interview, I've been wanting to try it, but, and you can tell us how. But to be honest, the reason why I haven't is just because I haven't been able to get the kefir grains easily. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, milk kefir is the number one most studied fermented food on the planet. So there is tons and tons of, like, what we call preclinical studies, which is essentially on humans. So not on humans, on animals or on cell cultures and things like that. That's preclinical. But there's also some clinical studies on humans that have been conducted as well. So there's heaps of good science behind why milk kefir is the number one in my belief. So it's very high in couple of different things. So it's very high in probiotics. So it's got anywhere between 30 and 100 strains of beneficial bacteria. So huge tick. It's got prebiotics in there. So it's got a compound called kefiran, which is a prebiotic. So prebiotic means it feeds good bacteria in the gut. And prebiotics typically target lactobacilli and bifidobacteria, which are the almost like the peacekeeping bacteria in the gut. So super important to have those ones in there at substantial levels. Bifidobacteria particularly are important because they produce, or they're a reservoir for tryptophan. And kefir, milk kefir itself has a fair whack of tryptophan in there, but the bifidobacteria also produce tryptophan. why tryptophan is so important is because tryptophan is a precursor molecule for serotonin. So tryptophan gets converted to serotonin, and then serotonin gets converted to melatonin. So it's very important to have those precursor molecules present at substantial levels to actually facilitate the conversion process. So those are the main benefits. But then milk kefir has all these other medicinal benefits. There's these things called functional peptides in there. And those functional peptides have been shown to mimic certain pharmaceutical drugs that are related to lowering blood sugar, lowering blood pressure, improving mood, being antibiotic in nature. That means having the ability to kill certain types of bacteria, typically pathogens like Salmonella or E. coli or Listeria. So these bacteria in kefir can actually kill pathogens. So it's very, very powerful medicinal fermented food. And the list goes on. I mean, on and on. I recently interviewed the world expert. There's a guy, Professor Paul Cotter from the University of Cork in Ireland, that's doing tons and tons of research on kefir. So that podcast will come out pretty soon. But the research is amazing, and it's only getting stronger and stronger. And milk kefir, I mean, all you need is kefir grains and milk, and you can reuse these kefir grains forever. I mean, it's the most cost-effective, bang for buck medicinal product on the planet, essentially, because you get the kefir grains once and then you just keep reusing it to make milk kefir.
Can you give us a summary of how to make it and what kefir grains actually are and where we can get them?
Yeah, essentially kefir grains, they're from nature. It's the lore, the history behind it is that it's very, very ancient. There's mentions of it in the Old Testament. Then there's mentions of it through, you know, Marco Polo's travels through Mongolia, you know, so the Mongol tribes were making some form of fermented milk product with horse milk and potentially kefir grains. But where it kind of emerges into more modern history is that I think in the 16th century it pops up in France, where a king was really sick, and then a doctor came from the Middle East and brought some kefir grains with him with 100 sheep, and then cured the king, and the king called it the milk of eternal life. But then from a scientific perspective, around, would it be in the early 1900s, a guy by the name of Elie Metchnikoff, who's known as the father of probiotics, he was the one that kind of did all the very early research on probiotics and coined the term. But he was a contemporary of Louis Pasteur, very, very famous scientist as well. And he was doing these research on all these tribes, especially in Bulgaria, that were living above 100. So he was obsessed with immortality and living forever and whatnot. But he discovered that one of the common threads is that they were consuming a high level of these fermented dairy products like kefir. So this is the history of it. And in terms of making it, it's so easy. I mean, all you do is get a glass jar and you put kefir grains in the jar. So for a teaspoon of kefir grains, you add 250 mils of milk. You let that ferment for 24 hours. You pass that yogurt now through a sieve of some form. It can be a stainless steel or even a nylon type sieve. And then you push that yogurt through, and what will remain on the sieve is your kefir grains. Then you simply get your kefir grains, you put it back into that glass jar, put more milk, and start the process again. And the jar, you just cover it with a cloth and a rubber band. And that is it. Dylan, it's not rocket science, really simple.
And what are the kefir grains?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. So kefir grains, again, it's from nature. So all they are a symbiotic culture of bacteria and yeast. So scientists can't replicate the grain in a lab. It's way too complex. So all we can do is really just allow the grain itself to replicate. And this is how people spread or share the grains, or you can buy it from us. So once you get the grains replicate. And what happens is the bacteria and the yeast are symbiotic. So they're like, in science, they're called a biofilm. So they're just a group of bacteria and yeast that collaborate with each other, and they work as a team almost. There's a concept called quorum sensing, where the actual bacteria and yeasts are all collaborating for the greater good of that tribe, or that group of bacteria and yeast. And then what they do is they secrete a polysaccharide. So all polysaccharides are is just bits of sugar joined together, like not sucrose sugar, but just like very simple carbohydrates. And they produce like this almost like a sticky gum. And this gum is like the kefir grain. So it's just almost like bits of jelly. So what will happen when you're making your kefir grains is they'll slowly start to replicate. So the bigger grains just literally just drop off little small bits of other grains. So very quickly, from a teaspoon of kefir grains, will very quickly replicate to having more and more every batch you make.
Cool. Can't wait to try. And they must be hard, right, in order to keep them when you strain out the yogurt.
They're kind of like bits of jelly, but they're solid. So they don't dissolve. So they will remain on the sieve. So depending on how fine your sieve is, so it's good to use a relatively fine sieve. And that will capture all the grains. And then you literally just use the keep reusing the grains. And there's another type of grain, say for someone that doesn't tolerate dairy very well, there's another species of grains. It comes from a very different place. So the milk kefir grains originate from the Caucasus Mountains. That's the common source of where most modern grains come from. There's another type that actually comes from Mexico. So the tribes in Mexico actually found it inside prickly pears. So they had these pears in Mexico, and somewhere along the lines in history, they opened up a pear and they found these what we call water kefir grains living inside. But that fermentation is actually using water, so good quality water, no chemicals, no fluoride, no chlorine, and just sugar. And what that does is it creates a water kefir, which is more like a fermented beverage, slightly effervescent, slightly sour, slightly yeasty, bready, similar to kombucha, but far more beneficial bacteria. There's around 15 strains of bacteria, and they also have unique bifidobacteria species to the water kefir grain. So it's very, very good. A good alternative to milk kefir grains if dairy is not your thing.
Fascinating. And the milk kefir grains was found in the mountain, in the ground, or?
The law behind it is uncertain, but what I hypothesize is that somewhere along the lines, whether it's the, you know, somewhere in the Middle East, there's most likely that Eurasian steppe area. Maybe they even found it inside the stomach of a goat or something like that, and they just started to just propagate it and just keep growing it. It's just something that would have spontaneously happened when a group of bacteria and yeast formed a biofilm, and then humans decided to use the biofilm to make this yogurt. So they kept on passing it on to other people and they spread it. So it would have spontaneously happened at some form, most likely in the stomach of a goat or something like that. That's my thinking.
Cool. And we'll put a link in the show notes to where to buy your milk kefir grains, because I'm definitely going to. And I would like you to comment on the similarities or differences between buttermilk or thin lassi, because that's something I'm a big fan of. And my teacher always says, you know, that's all nature's pharmacies, and like that's the best probiotic, which is you can either make it by buttermilk or you can just mix yogurt with water. It's like a diluted yogurt, but it's very different to yogurt because yogurt is heavy to digest and it also heats the body. But the lassi, or the thin lassi, is a better word because it is thin lassi, is cooling and easily to digest. So what's the differences?
Yeah, I mean, the buttermilk is just a, it's just almost like a byproduct of butter making. You know, when you're churning the cream, the watery substrate that's left is the buttermilk. And especially if you're using a raw milk source, it's impossible now in Australia pretty much. But to get the natural microbes that are in the buttermilk and then use that as a starter culture. And then a thin lassi really depends on what sort of starter culture you're using to make that thin yogurt. Certain cultures or yogurt cultures produce a thinner viscosity. And that's the only way that I can think that would determine the thickness of that product versus a thicker yogurt product. It just really depends on the bacteria that you're using in there. I'm not familiar with any natural way of making these products. I'm definitely not an expert in fermenting buttermilk or lassi.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I look very much forward to trying it. Okay. I just wanted, like, we know these microbes are very sensitive to not only the impact our mental state, but they're sensitive to our mental state. Like if we have, for example, a bowl of yogurt, which is very rich in microbes and bacteria on the table, and we have a fight with each other across the table, we know that the bad microbes, they proliferate, and the good microbes aren't as proliferative. So obviously this is with food. Food is sensitive to us, and if you cook with love, the food will be much have better life force and more nutritious. That's why mum's cooking is the best, and why you can even go to a 5-star restaurant, which is meant to be the best, but the kitchens are full of stress. So the food is not as I guess nutrient delivering and fulfilling. So I think like what, and also this is like, yeah. So what's your take on that? And,
yeah, the literature suggests that things like cognitive behavior therapy, so that's like going and seeing a psychiatrist and dealing through traumas and whatnot, that's been shown to actually impact the composition of the gut microbiome. So there's definitely this bi-directional connection. So things like dealing with trauma, dealing with stress, having gratitude will definitely impact the composition of the gut microbiome either way. So, you know, if you're in a stressful environment, that's going to also impact the gut microbiome. But, you know, there's definitely good feelings that come with mum's cooking and having a kitchen full of love. I mean, we don't need science to tell us that. I think intuitively we know that as humans being social creatures, eating bread together, breaking bread together, having a meal together, even the blue zones and all these longevity studies in Sardinia and Ikaria and Okinawa, these people, there's some element of community, family, connection, love that lends itself to people living more vibrant lives, longer lives, meaningful lives.
The reason I bring that up is because, as you alluded to earlier, you know, we are mostly bugs. Like we are not even most, you know, what, 90% of us are microbiome?
It's roughly, the latest science is roughly 1-to-1. It used to be 10-to-1. It's been since revised to roughly 1-to-1. So you're more microbe than human cells, but from a genetic point of view, there's 100 times more genes, microbial genes, than human genes.
Okay, sure. So if that's the case, then that's what, and we look at these, say, enlightened beings or yogic masters, and they're just by having that high state of consciousness and, you know, supreme contentedness and in such bliss all the time. So is there any other things you think is absolutely essential for microbiome health and gut health that we haven't mentioned, thus mental health?
It's pretty, my advice is pretty simple. Just eat really clean, definitely avoid processed foods, be very cognizant of the antibiotics coming through our meat products, especially farm fish, making sure that you getting that sunlight exposure through the day, setting your circadian rhythms and rhythmicity. Not many people are talking about rhythmicity. This is very emerging science. And rhythmicity just means that you have the same eating habits and sleeping habits and exposure habits through the day to create consistency in the actual gut flora. So waking up the same time, going to bed at the same time, getting those light exposures at the same time, eating at the same time, going to the toilet number twos at the same time. So as much as it can, setting rhythmicity, because what happens is there's a concept called social jet lag. So we all know jet lag has been you go to a different country and then the timing's out of whack, the sunlight is out of whack. The body feels pretty terrible because you're adjusting to a new time zone. But it's the same thing with social jet lag that we typically have more consistency through the day, so through the week. But then when it comes to the weekend where like maybe people are going out later, they're staying up later, they're socializing later, that creates something called social jet lag. So you might have a big night on a Friday night or a Saturday night, and then you're feeling pretty horrible the next day. So again, as much as we can to keep consistency for that 7-day period, not interrupt that rhythmicity as much as you can. So that's the best advice. And the obvious one is just having lots of diversity of plant foods and implementing fermented foods into your diet. Try to include a fermented food in each and every meal. So it could mean having some kefir in the morning, having a side of miso paste or just a little bit of sauerkraut in the side of your dish or kimchi, having some miso soup, having a glass of kombucha. So every meal being mindful of having some form of ferment, because these things are full of beneficial bacteria. Things like GABA that can improve your mood, but also bucket loads of enzymes that help with digestion, especially things like miso have heaps of digestive enzymes in there.
Mm, wonderful.
Yeah, and then just blocking blue light at night, turning off your Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, especially during the sleeping time, keeping a sleep sanctuary, making sure your sleep sanctuary is pure, you know, no artificial lighting, keeping your phone away from the body, making sure it's on airplane mode, turning off Wi-Fi. And down the track, if you want to invest in something like kill switches on your houses, that's also really beneficial, because then you just take all the dirty electricity out of your room when you're sleeping.
Wonderful. Yeah, and just emphasize the regularity in Ayurveda, Vata, which is like the king of the doshas, and which is regulates the nervous system. And the king of the doshas means it regulates all the other biological functions or doshas. The best way to balance that is regularity. So it's very important. Okay, thanks so much, Kribin. The way people can listen to you more is through your awesome podcast, Gut Health Gurus, and you've got a online shop with heaps of cool fermented products and kits and stuff. Anything else?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the best way to get me is I'm very active on Instagram. So if you just search my name, Kribin Govender, or if you search Gut Health Gurus. So Gut Health Gurus is the podcast, and it's my Facebook site, which is Gut Health Gurus by Kribin Govender. So if you want to find me there. We have a YouTube channel as well called Gut Health Gurus. And I also have a support group now with more than coming up to 13,000 members. So it's a private group. So you can find a support group on Facebook. So it's just Gut Health Gurus. So you pretty much Gut Health Gurus everywhere.
Cool. Awesome.
And obviously my company is called Nourish Me Organics. So we also have all the social handles for Nourish Me Organics.
Beautiful. All right. Thanks so much, mate.
My pleasure.
You made it to the end. Thank you. You care about your health. You want to invest your time and energy in your health and value it. And you have a thirst for wisdom. Congratulations. So if you want to support this show, leave a review, subscribe, share it with some friends, share a screenshot on Instagram. And yeah, I love your support. It's a big thing. It all just got a bit more, requires more resources now that all these podcast things are upping their prices with posting and everything. And anyway, until next time, don't know what episode is going to be next. Got a few in the bank that I got to choose from, but we got some good stuff coming up. We got in the future coming up with Dr. Suhas Krishnagar, who's an amazing, one of the prominent Ayurvedic doctors in America right now. He's in California. We'll have one with Gary Goro and perhaps the second one with the wonderful Mark Cohen, who was on earlier on talking about water. And now he's going to really talk about wellness, the we in wellness, and has a view on collective wellness. But anyway, hey, I'm just putting it out there. I haven't even recorded that yet, but I haven't even spoken to him about it yet, but I know it's going to come. I will manifest it. Okay, much love. Until next time.